Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of folk heroes. I'm Paul Brasson.
And I'm Jace Neeling, and welcome to a bonus episode. We're telling some folk tales today. Each of us picked out some good stuff.
Dude, I like how pumped up you are. Do you have like some really good stories picked out for us?
I'm a little excited about this one.
Okay.
I don't know what took us so long to get to this one, because the one I picked out, maybe the most famous folktale in Japan. I feel like it's the one that people are most likely to have heard of outside of Japan.
Okay. I bet a few people are guessing right now.
Probably. I bet some of them are right. Should we just jump into it? Do we need to
come up with an intro today? Should we explain why? I think we mentioned it briefly at the end of the last episode.
Sure, go ahead.
Jason works really, really hard, and he took a well-deserved and earned vacation.
I appreciate that.
We wanted to do an episode where Jason wouldn't have to do a bunch of research while he was on vacation. So we're going to read some folktales today.
That's right.
Any compliments for me?
Paul also works very hard, and he deserved a break too. What did you do with your time that you didn't have to spend researching, Paul?
Football manager.
Ah, okay.
Not nearly enough time too. I'm so into that game. Oh my God, if I didn't have a job, I would be playing like 10 hours a day right now. Like, that's how into that game I am.
Paul likes boring sports games for some reason, everybody. I don't understand it. I really don't. Like, he plays... So the game he was really into right before this was a baseball game, but you don't even play the baseball. You're just like managing teams and like looking at statistics and stuff. I don't get it.
It's best to be at top. Don't be the player. Be the one that buys and sells the players.
Okay. So do you like buy up other teams? Can you eventually own the entire MLB or something?
No, but you can be the best team every year.
All right. So this football manager thing, I assume it's pretty similar, just a different sport?
Yeah. So it's soccer in America, or football in the rest of the world. But it has almost every professional league in the world. So you can go manage a Bundesliga team in Germany, or any of the nine or whatever divisions in England, or you can do the MLS here in America. They have Colombia, Brazil, I think Saudi Arabia, Japan... So I just think it's really cool. It's interesting for me because I grew up playing soccer and I like soccer, but I haven't watched a ton of it professionally. And the rules are like really different than the rules are in America.
Really?
Yeah. Like instead of trading players, you have to pay a fee to have the right to negotiate with them. So you're kind of like buying players. But you can also develop players. They sign players to contracts when they're like 14 or something in Europe and kind of like have them play for the club and develop until they're old enough to hopefully someday play on the top squad.
Wow. I did not expect a video game / sports intro to this episode.
Yeah, but I need to stop because I could literally go forever. I've probably gone too far already.
Well, now I need to talk about the game I've been playing. I just finished Dishonored yesterday. Really solid game.
You finished.
I did. It's not a very long game. You can beat it in like 12 hours, but it's very replayable because I was already telling you about this game. Like your actions affect how the world develops, you know, and you get different endings depending on how you approach different situations.
So. You're talking about replayable. I'm playing games that never end.
I don't even replay games. I honestly don't care about replayability. I don't care to play this game again. I really love... variety. I go through a single player game, I finish it, I never touch it again. I go to a different game and I just keep jumping around like that. That's my style.
You've got your list.
Yeah, but Dishonored, really solid. And it's like a pretty old game at this point too, but it's just really well made, really engaging, really fun. The gameplay is smooth and satisfying. And
my theory about video games is that very few good video games ever get outdated. Like, doesn't matter where the technology goes, like, Tetris will always be a game that people play.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same. Like, even Mario, like, it's just a fun game with the basic graphics and the side-scroller. I think that will keep on living on.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you don't need ultra-realistic graphics to make a good game.
If the story and the gameplay mechanics are both there, it's just going to be a good game.
Yeah. Do we need to make a spin-off video game podcast now?
It'd be interesting because we would never agree on anything.
I know. We have such different styles of gaming.
I think the only overlap would be music games, rhythm games.
Oh, yeah.
That might be like the only overlap we have.
You said that you were thinking about getting Project Diva, didn't you?
Yeah.
Why did that never happen?
I never got around to it.
Do you even have any rhythm games you can play right now?
I still really want to get Taiko, and I never got around to getting
it. Get it.
I just should. You're right. I just hate spending money, Jason.
Well, I can understand that.
I just never think, I should go spend money today. Even though in one moment I decided I'm going to buy the game, by the time it gets around to me buying the game, I don't want to buy the game. Or I want to buy the game, but I don't want to spend the money.
So we're talking about folklore today.
Yeah, I think that's enough sidetracking for now. I know you've got like the big one everyone's waiting for, but can I go first?
Absolutely. Well, so you said you had a couple.
I do.
I have one pretty long one. I don't know how long this episode is going to end up being. So I was thinking you go first, I'll do the big one in the middle, and if we have time, we get a third one.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think my first one's pretty long too, but I'm not sure if that means 10 minutes or 30 minutes.
Okay, well, we're in no rush. Got anywhere to be?
Definitely not.
Good.
Except right here. This is where I got
to
be.
This is the best place to be. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
All right, so this one is interesting too, because this is the first time that this is a story about China, but it's a Japanese folktale about China. And actually, the names in here are very Japanese, which is kind of interesting.
I'm intrigued.
But you know how so much of the literary history in Japan came from China? So I'm sure there was influence before and after that about Chinese stories, right?
Sure.
So this is another one that was translated by Ye Theodora Ozaki. We have done a number of hers before as well.
You have the name of the collection that it's from?
Japanese Fairy Tales.
Published when?
It doesn't say here. I think it was early 1900s, if I remember
correctly.
Around
there, yeah.
This tale is called The Stones of Five Colors and the Empress Jokwa, an old Chinese story. You gonna be ready for some voices?
Oh, you know I am.
All right. Long, long ago, there lived a great Chinese empress who succeeded her brother, the Emperor Fuki. It was the age of giants. And the Empress Jokwa, for that was her name, was 25 feet high, nearly as tall as her brother. She was a wonderful woman and an able ruler. There's an interesting story of how she mended a part of the broken heavens and one of the terrestrial pillars which upheld the sky, both of which were damaged during a rebellion raised by one of King Fuki's subjects. The rebel's name was Kokai. He was 26 feet high. His body was entirely covered with hair, and his face was as black as iron. He was a wizard and a very terrible character indeed. When the Emperor Fuki died, Kokai was bitten with the ambition to be Emperor of China, but his plan failed, and Jokwa, the dead emperor's sister, mounted the throne. Kokai was so angry at being thwarted in his desire that he raised a revolt. His first act was to employ the water devil, who caused a great flood to rush over the country. I feel like we're getting to Chainsaw Man now. These elemental devils are appearing.
Mm, sure.
This swamped the poor people out of their homes, and when the Empress Jokwa saw the plight of her subjects and knew it was Kokai's fault, she declared war against him. Now, Jokwa the Empress had two young warriors called Hako and Eiko, and the former she made general of the front forces. Hako was delighted that the Empress's choice should fall on him, and he prepared himself for battle. He took up the longest lance he could find and mounted a red horse, and was just about to set out when he heard someone galloping hard behind him and shouting, "Hako, stop! The general of the front forces must be I!" He looked back and saw Eiko, his comrade, riding on a white horse in the act of unsheathing a large sword to draw upon him. Hako's anger was kindled, And as he turned to face his rival, he cried,
"Insolent wretch! I have been appointed by the Empress to lead the front forces to battle. Do you dare to stop me?"
"Yes," answered Aiko. "I ought to lead the army. It is you who should follow me." At this bold reply, Hako's anger burst from a spark into a flame.
"Dare you answer me thus? Take that!"
And he lunged at him with his lance. But Aiko moved quickly aside, and at the same time raising his sword, he wounded the head of the general's horse. Obliged to dismount, Hako was about to rush at his antagonist when Aiko, as quick as lightning, tore from his breast the badge of commandership and galloped away. The action was so quick that Hako stood dazed, not knowing what to do.
Don't these guys realize they're on the same side? Like, how unprofessional, right?
Right, these are the top two guys in the army.
Yeah, doesn't bode well.
No discipline here at all. The Empress had been a spectator of the scene, and she could not but admire the quickness of the ambitious Aiko. And in order to pacify the rivals, she determined to appoint them both to the generalship of the front army.
Okay, I guess that's one way to perceive that.
Having two equal leaders in an army with none of them clearly in charge has never gone wrong before in human history, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So Hako was made commander of the left wing of the front army and Aiko of the right. 100,000 soldiers followed them and marched to put down the rebel Kokai. Within a short time, the two generals reached the castle where Kokai had fortified himself. When aware of their approach, the wizard said, "I will blow these two poor children away with one breath." He little thought how hard he would find the fight. With these words, Kokai seized an iron rod and mounted a black horse and rushed forth like an angry tiger to meet his two foes. As the two young warriors saw him tearing down upon them, they said to each other, "Are we going to say this in unison? Yeah.
We must not let him escape alive.
And they attacked him from the right and from the left, with sword and with lance.
But Aiko said, "Jinx." And the other guy wasn't allowed to talk.
But the all-powerful Kokai was not to be easily beaten. He whirled his iron rod round like a great water wheel. And for a long time they fought thus, neither side gaining nor losing. At last, to avoid the wizard's iron rod, Hako turned his horse too quickly. The animal's hoofs struck against a large stone, and in a fright, the horse reared as straight on end as a screen, throwing his master to the ground. Thereupon, Kokai drew his three-edged sword and was about to kill the prostrate Hako. But before the wizard could work his wicked will, the brave Aiko had wheeled his horse in front of Kokai and dared him to try his strength with him, and not to kill a fallen man. But Kokai was tired, and he did not feel inclined to face this fresh and dauntless young soldier. So suddenly wheeling his horse round, he fled from the fray. Hako, who had only been slightly stunned, had by this time got upon his feet, and he and his comrade rushed after the retreating enemy, the one on foot and the other on horseback. Kokai, seeing that he was pursued, turned upon his nearest assailant, who was, of course, the mounted Aiko, and drawing forth an arrow from the quiver at his back, fitted it to his bow and drew upon Aiko. As quick as lightning, the wary Aiko avoided the shaft, which only touched his helmet strings, and glancing off, fell harmless against Hako's coat of armor.
What are helmet strings? The ones that are like under his chin?
Yeah, it must be like decorations hanging from his helmet is what I imagine.
Okay.
The wizard saw that both his enemies remained unscathed. He also knew that there was no time to pull a second arrow before they would be upon him. So to save himself, he resorted to magic. He stretched forth his wand, and immediately a great flood arose. And Jokwa's army and her brave young generals were swept away like a falling of autumn leaves on a stream.
That's cheating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised you didn't go with the wand first. But he had a rod. He had a three-edged sword, which is a unique weapon. And then he's got a wand. This guy's crazy.
He's got all the little gizmos and gadgets.
Well, he is a wizard. Hako and Eiko found themselves struggling neck deep in water. And looking round, they saw the ferocious Kokai making towards them through the water with his iron rod on high. They thought every moment that they would be cut down, but they bravely struck out to swim as far as they could from Kokai's reach. All of a sudden, they found themselves in front of what seemed to be an island rising straight out of the water. They looked up, and there stood an old man with hair as white as snow, smiling at them. They cried to him to help them. The old man nodded his head and came down to the edge of the water. As soon as his feet touched the flood, it divided, and a good road appeared to the amazement of the drowning men, who now found themselves safe.
It's Moses?
Chinese Moses? Kokai had by this time reached the island, which had risen as if by a miracle out of the water. As seeing his enemies thus saved, he was furious. He rushed through the water upon the old man, and it seemed as if he would surely be killed. But the old man appeared not in the least dismayed and calmly awaited the wizard's onslaught. As Kokai drew near, the old man laughed aloud merrily, and turning into a large and beautiful white crane, flapped his wings and flew upwards into the heavens.
I don't remember that part in the Bible.
When Hako and Eiko saw this, they knew that their deliverer was no mere human being, was perhaps a god in disguise. And they hoped later on to find out who the venerable old man was. In the meantime, they had retreated, and it being now the close of day, for the sun was setting, both Kokai and the young warriors gave up the idea of fighting more that day.
They're all just like, okay, let's call it quits for the day. I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. War's over for the night, guys. Go home. That night, Hako and Eiko decided that it was useless to fight against the wizard Kokai, for he had supernatural powers. Well, they were only human. I mean, excuses, but not a terrible one.
I wouldn't want to fight this guy.
So they presented themselves before the Empress Jokwa, and after a long consultation, the Empress decided to ask the Fire King, Shikuyu, to help her against the rebel wizard and to lead her army against him. Now, Shikuyu, the Fire King, lived at the South Pole.
What?
Yeah, how long ago did they know about the South Pole?
Fire King? It seems like the worst place for him.
Well, Jason.
I just read the next sentence.
It was the only safe place for him to be in, for he burnt up everything around him anywhere else. But it was impossible to burn up ice and snow.
Well, okay, that makes perfect sense. I take it back.
Yeah, they explained. To look at, he was a giant and stood 30 feet high. His face was just like marble, and his hair and beard long and as white as snow. His strength was stupendous, and he was master of all fire, just as Kokai was water.
Surely,
thought the Empress,
Shikuyu can conquer Kokai.
So she sent Eiko to the South Pole to beg Shikuyu to take the war against Kokai into his own hands and conquer him once for all. The Fire King, on hearing the Empress's request, smiled and said,
That is an easy matter, to be sure. It was none other than I who came to your rescue when you and your companion were drowning in the flood raised by Kokai.
Good voice. That totally sounds like a Fire King.
Thank you. Eiko was surprised at learning this. He thanked the Fire King for coming to the rescue in their dire need, and then besought him to return with him and lead the war and defeat the wicked Kokai. Shikuyu did as he was asked and returned with Eiko to the Empress. She welcomed the Fire King cordially and at once told him why she had sent for him, to ask him to be the generalissimo of her army. That's generalissimo. That is the word in the translation.
Yep.
His reply was very reassuring. Do not have any anxiety. I will certainly kill Kokai. Shikuyu then placed himself at the head of 30,000 soldiers, and with Hako and Eiko showing the way, marched to the enemy's castle. The Fire King knew the secret of Kokai's power, and he now told all the soldiers to gather a certain kind of shrub. This they burned in large quantities, and each soldier was then ordered to fill a bag full of the ashes thus obtained. Kokai, on the other hand, in his own conceit, thought that Shikuyu was of inferior power to himself, and he murmured angrily, "Even though you are Fire King, I can soon extinguish you." Then he repeated an incantation, and the water floods rose and welled as high as mountains. Shikuyu, not in the least frightened, ordered his soldiers to scatter the ashes which he had caused them to make. Every man did as he was bid, and such was the power of the plant that they had burned that as soon as the ashes mingled with the water, a stiff mud was formed, and they were all safe from drowning. Now Kokai the wizard was dismayed when he saw that the Fire King was superior wisdom to himself, and his anger was so great that he rushed headlong towards the enemy. Eiko rode to meet him, and the two fought together for some time. They were well matched in a hand-to-hand combat. Hako, who was carefully watching the fray, saw that Eiko began to tire, and fearing that his companion would be killed, he took his place. But Kokai was tired as well, and feeling himself unable to hold out against Hako, he said artfully, "You are too magnanimous, thus to fight for your friend and run the risk of being killed. I will not hurt such a good man." He pretended to retreat, turning away the head of his horse. His intention was to throw Hako off his guard and then to wheel round and take him by surprise.
How dishonorable.
Right? But Shikuyu understood the wily wizard, and he spoke at once. "You are a coward. You cannot deceive me." Saying this, the Fire King made a sign to the unwary Hako to attack him. Kokai now turned upon Shikuyu furiously, but he was tired and unable to fight well, and he soon received a wound in his shoulder. He now broke from the fray and tried to escape in earnest. While the fight between their leaders had been going on, the two armies had stood waiting for the issue. Shikuyu now turned and bade Jokwa's soldiers charge the enemy's forces. This they did, and routed them with great slaughter, and the wizard barely escaped with his life. It was in vain that Kokai called upon the water devil to help him, for Shikuyu knew the counter charm. The wizard found that the battle was against him. Mad with pain, for his wound began to trouble him, and frenzied with disappointment and fear, he dashed his head upon the rocks of Mount Shu and died on the spot.
Whoa.
Quite the way to go out. There was an end of the wicked Kokai, but not of trouble in the Empress Jokwa's kingdom, as you shall see. The force with which the wizard fell against the rocks was so great that the mountain burst, and fire rushed out from the earth, and one of the pillars upholding the heavens was broken so that one corner of the sky dropped till it touched the earth.
Wow. I'm totally visualizing that as like a scene in an anime, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's just like such a massive explosion when this guy hits the rock.
Right.
Everything just gets...
I want to see this story in like the film style of Hero.
Totally. That'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah. Shikuyu, the Fire King, took up the body of the wizard and carried it to the Empress Jokwa, who rejoiced greatly that her enemy was vanquished and her generals victorious. She showered all manner of gifts and honors upon Shikuyu, but all this time fire was bursting from the mountain broken by the fall of Kokai. Whole villages were destroyed, rice fields burnt up, riverbeds filled with the burning lava, and the homeless people were in great distress. So the empress left the capital as soon as she had rewarded the victor Shikuyu and journeyed with all speed to the scene of the disaster. She found that both heaven and earth had sustained damage, and the place was so dark that she had to light her lamp to find out the extent of the havoc that had been wrought. Having ascertained this, she set to work at repairs. To this, she ordered her subjects to collect stones of 5 colors, blue, yellow, red, white, and black.
There they are, yep. The ones from the title.
Finally showed up. When she had obtained these, she boiled them with a kind of porcelain in a large cauldron, and the mixture became a beautiful paste. And with this, she knew that she could mend the sky. Now all was ready. Summoning the clouds that were sailing ever so high above her head, she mounted them and rode heavenwards, carrying in her hands the vase containing the paste made from the stones of 5 colors. She soon reached the corner of the sky that was broken and applied the paste and mended it. Having done this, she turned her attention to the broken pillar, and with the legs of a very large tortoise, she mended it.
What does that mean? How did she use the legs of this tortoise? I must know.
That's up to your imagination, Jason, because you're not getting any more details.
He just ripped off all his legs, stacked them on top of each other, made them into a pillar? Or is she just standing on the tortoise's back to reach or something?
Does that tortoise just have to stand there now and yeah. He's the pillar?
Like, oh, man. Gotta hold this forever, like Atlas.
When this was finished, she mounted the clouds and descended to the earth, hoping to find that all was now right. But to her dismay, she found that it was still quite dark. Neither the sun shone by day nor the moon by night. Greatly perplexed, she at last called a meeting of all the wise men of the kingdom and asked their advice as to what she should do in this dilemma. 2 of the wisest said,
"The roads of heaven have been damaged by the late accident, and the sun and moon have been obliged to stay at home. Neither the sun could make his daily journey, nor the moon her nightly one, because of the bad roads. The sun and moon do not yet know that your majesty has mended all that was damaged, so we will go and inform them that since you have repaired them, the roads are safe."
The empress approved of what the wise men suggested and ordered them to set out on their mission. But this was not easy, for the palace of the sun and moon was many, many hundreds of thousands of miles distant into the east. If they traveled on foot, they might never reach the place. They would die of old age on the road. But Jokwa had recourse to magic. She gave her 2 ambassadors wonderful chariots, which could whirl through the air by magic power 1,000 miles per minute. They set out in good spirits, riding above the clouds, and after many days, they reached the country where the sun and moon were living happily together. At this point, I kind of want someone to like check the math. Like, many hundreds of thousands of miles, is that actually how far away the sun is from us?
Let me ask Siri. How many miles away is the sun? Sun is approximately 93 million miles away. So many, many hundreds of thousands? I mean, sure.
Okay. And then I guess at some point, what was the chariot? 1,000 miles a minute or something?
1,000 miles a minute.
Okay.
Okay, let's see how many minutes that would be. 93,000 minutes. 64 days?
Okay, I believe it.
I mean, there's a whole lot of words like many, many. Yeah, so right, I guess, right. Sure, it works out.
It says
out.
It took them many days to get there. Plausible. Good job, ancient astronomers. The two ambassadors were granted an interview with their majesties of light and asked them why they had for so many days secluded themselves from the universe. Did they not know that by doing so, they plunged the world and all its people into utmost darkness both day and night? Replied the sun and the moon.
Really take some creative license here. Like, have some fun with it. What does the sun sound like?
I feel like the sun's flamboyant.
Totally. He's all powerful and he knows it. He knows how much people are depending on him, you know? Not that I didn't mean to gender the sun. Yeah, they.
Mother sun. The sun. Surely you know that Mount Shu.
No, go further, Paul. Take it further.
Further? That's
flamboyant. You said flamboyant.
I mean, I only have so many voices.
Get extreme with it. I'm producing you right now.
Maybe should I get more indignant?
Get wacky. Just get wacky indignant. With it.
Surely you know that Mount Shu has suddenly burst forth with fire, and the roads of heaven have been greatly damaged. I, the sun, found it impossible to make my daily journey along such rough roads. And certainly the moon could not issue forth at night. So we both retired into private life for a time.
I love it. I feel like I got hints of Christopher Walken in there. That was, I like that.
Okay,
so
I don't know what that was, but you produced it, so thank you, Jason. Then the two wise men bowed themselves to the ground and said,
"Our Empress Jokwa has already repaired the roads with the wonderful stones of five colors. So we beg to assure your majesties that the roads are just as they were before the eruption took place."
But the sun and the moon still hesitated, saying that they had heard that one of the pillars of heaven had been broken as well, and they feared that, even if the roads had been remade, it would still be dangerous for them to sally forth on their usual journeys.
Who have they been talking to? Who's telling them this stuff? They got like a whole council of stars. They all get together. And
they've
like,
got, they've,
did the, you pe- hear?
People talk in the heavens, Jason.
Are all the other stars also, I don't know. Where is heaven in relation to the sun and the moon? Like, who could be closer that's telling them this stuff, you know?
You ask great questions, Jason.
Thanks.
I don't have the answers.
I feel like whenever we're talking about these folktales, I have a lot of questions and yeah. Not many answers.
Why were people just randomly giants in this story?
Oh, I've heard about the Age of Giants. That's the thing.
Oh, okay.
Oh, is this me?
This is you.
Oh, sorry.
"You need have no anxiety about the broken pillar,"
said the two ambassadors.
"Our empress restored it with the legs of a great tortoise, and it is as firm as ever it was. She ripped off the legs of this tortoise and stacked it. It was amazing. You should have seen it."
I love how they just say that in this story. Like, that's just totally like, yeah. No other explanation needed.
Right.
Oh, no, she used the leg of a great tortoise. It's all good now.
Oh, yeah, the tortoise legs, of course.
Then the sun and moon appeared satisfied, and they both set out to try the roads. They found that what the Empress's deputies had told them was correct. After the examination of the heavenly roads, the sun and moon again gave light to the earth. All the people rejoiced greatly, and peace and prosperity were secured in China for a long time under the reign of the wise Empress Jokwa. The end.
Nice. That's a fun one.
Yeah, the story went a lot of, like, started with these huge battles and rebellion and secession, and then it turned into, like, saving the world.
Yeah, a lot happened.
We met, like, the sun. He was a cool guy.
I was impressed by the scale of it, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff in there reminded me of anime somehow, how it just like it starts out with these characters and it just keeps getting bigger yeah, and bigger right, and eventually right. The sky is lopsided and hanging down.
Well, you know, these are ancient folktales. Now we see where some of that stuff originates yeah. from.
I'm not sure I get like why is Japan telling these folktales about what happened in China?
Because I think I'm totally just guessing here, but China had even a more ancient history than Japan, right? So if Japanese people hundreds of years ago were talking about the way past, it's easier to say like long, long, long ago in China.
I mean, it depends on how you define history, I guess, because of course there were people in Japan.
Yeah. But like recorded history goes way further back in China. So stories got written down long before.
Do you think maybe this was like a story that was in writing in China, but at the time that this was written down in China, Japan just had like oral folklore tradition?
Yeah, yeah. It could have got imported to Japan later. I have a feeling it was changed for in Japan. Like, I doubt this is exactly how the story went in Chinese.
I mean, all these stories in this whole collection, and any collection of folktales you find, there are tons of different versions of all of these. There's not like a single...
All these people's names are Japanese, right? Not Chinese. So probably the story got changed to fit more of like the Japanese voice. Yeah, I thought it was cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the story I'm reading is also from this collection of stories put together by Ye Theodora Ozaki. And like I said, this is a super famous folk tale. It's called Momotaro, or The Story of the Son of a Peach. At least that's what she's calling it in her collection. You know, it's just, I've heard it called, it does The Story of Momotaro, basically. Something like that.
Okay.
And it's so famous, Paul. It's so famous, in fact, that I'm wearing Momotaro jeans as we speak.
I was wondering.
These jeans were inspired by this folktale, and they have a bunch of elements
that relate to... The peach-colored inseam.
Yes, there's a pink inseam. There are peaches on the buttons. You can see Momotaro popping out of the peach on the leather patch on the back. The pocket bags have peaches on them. It's just, this folktale is intertwined into these jeans in so many ways. If you want to hear more about jeans, by the way, check out episode 68. That was about denim. And by the way, maybe this is a good time to mention, because I feel like I don't mention this often enough, but if you're ever wondering if we've spoken about a certain topic or anything, or you're looking for a specific episode, you can go to our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. On the navigation bar, there's you can find the episode list page. It's got a list of our episodes, but there's also a search bar at the top where you can type in anything and it'll bring up the episodes where we've mentioned that topic. So I just like went to our episode list. I typed in jeans and there you go. Episode 68 pops up. We also talked about Jean Street in the Chugoku region episode, apparently. So
yeah,
just wanted to call that out because it's a really useful way to find more information if you're looking for something specific.
Yes, absolutely. So, did you wear your Momotaros on purpose?
No, today? I was just randomly wearing them today. Okay. And then as I was trying to decide what to read, it was just a happy coincidence. Okay. That's all it was. Okay. But I hope you're ready with some fun voices for this one too, because we got some animals in here, talking animals.
I'll try. I don't know if I can top the sun, but...
That was pretty good.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay, here we go. Momotaro, or... The Story of the Son of a Peach. Long, long ago, there lived an old man and an old woman. They were peasants and had to work hard to earn their daily rice. The old man used to go and cut grass for the farmers around, and while he was gone, the old woman, his wife, did the work of the house and worked in their own little rice field. One day, the old man went to the hills as usual to cut grass, and the old woman took some clothes to the river to wash. It was nearly summer, and the country was very beautiful to see in its fresh greenness as the two old people went on their way to work. The grass on the banks of the river looked like emerald velvet, and the pussy willows along the edge of the water were shaking out their soft tassels. The breezes blew and ruffled the smooth surface of the water into wavelets, and passing on touched the cheeks of the old couple who, for some reason they could not explain, felt very happy that morning. The old woman at last found a nice spot by the riverbank and put her basket down. Then she set to work to wash the clothes. She took them one by one out of the basket and washed them in the river and rubbed them on the stones. The water was clear as crystal, and she could see the tiny fish swimming to and fro and the pebbles at the bottom. As she was busy washing her clothes, a great peach came bumping down the stream. The old woman looked up from her work and saw this large peach. She was 60 years of age, yet in all her life she had never seen such a big peach as this. I really kind of wish that the story gave us some frame of reference for how big this peach is, you know? Like, yeah. Is it just an abnormally large peach, like 6 inches across? Or is it like 4 feet across,
right,
you know?
Right.
I guess I'll do the old lady voice.
Okay.
How delicious that peach must be, she said to herself. I must certainly get it and take it home to my old man.
She stretched out her arm to try and get it, but it was quite out of her reach. She looked about for a stick, but there was not one to be seen, and if she went to look for one, she would lose the peach. Stopping a moment to think what she would do, she remembered an old charm verse. Now she began to clap her hands to keep time to the rolling of the peach downstream, and while she clapped, she sang this song.
Distant water is bitter, the near water is sweet. Pass by the distant water and come into the sweet.
Strange to say, as soon as she began to repeat this little song, the peach began to come nearer and nearer the bank where the old woman was standing, till at last it stopped just in front of her, so that she was able to take it up in her hands. The old woman was delighted. She could not go on with her work. So happy and excited was she, so she put all the clothes back in her bamboo basket, and with the basket on her back and the peach in her hand, she hurried homewards. It seemed a very long time to her to wait till her husband returned. The old man at last came back as the sun was setting, with a big bundle of grass on his back, so big that he was almost hidden, and she could hardly see him. He seemed very tired, and used the scythe for a walking stick, leaning on it as he walked along. As soon as the old woman saw him, she called out,
Ophison!
Which it says here means old man.
Okay.
I mean, old man should be Ogison. I don't know why it says F-I-I-son. Ophison. I'm not sure what that's about.
Translations weren't always standardized this long ago either.
Should I say Fison or Gison?
It says Fison. So I get that.
I'll say Fison.
Ophison, I've been waiting for you to come home for such a long time today.
What is the matter? Why are you so impatient?
Asked the old man, wondering at her unusual eagerness.
Has anything happened while I've been away?
Oh, no, answered the old woman. Nothing has happened, only I have found a nice present for you.
That is good,
said the old man. He then washed his feet in a basin of water and stepped up to the veranda. The old woman now ran into the little room and brought out from the cupboard the big peach. It felt even heavier than before. She held it up to him, saying,
Just look at this! Did you ever see such a large peach in all your life?
When the old man looked at the peach, he was greatly astonished and said,
This is indeed the largest peach I have ever seen. Wherever did you buy it?
I did not buy it, answered the old woman. I found it in the river where I was washing.
And she told him the whole story.
I am very glad that you found it. Let us eat it now, for I am hungry,
said the Ophison. She brought out the kitchen knife, and placing the peach on a board, was about to cut it, when, wonderful to tell, the peach split in two of itself, and a clear voice said,
Wait a bit, old man!
And out stepped a beautiful little child. The old man and his wife were both so astonished at what they saw that they fell to the ground. The child spoke again.
Don't be afraid. I am no demon or fairy. I will tell you the truth. Heaven has had compassion on you. Every day and every night, you have lamented that you had no child. Your cry has been heard, and I'm sent to be the son of your old age.
You have to be quite the experience to have, like, a little baby show up and just be like, Ha ha! I'm yours now!
I'm your son! On hearing this, the old man and his wife were very happy. They had cried night and day for sorrow at having no child to help them in their lonely old age, and now that their prayer was answered, they were so lost with joy that they did not know where to put their hands or their feet. First, the old man took the child up in his arms, and then the old woman did the same, and they named him Momotaro, or Son of a Peach, because he had come out of a peach, obviously. The years passed quickly by, and the child grew to be 15 years of age. He was taller and far stronger than any other boys of his own age. He had a handsome face and a heart full of courage, and he was very wise for his years. The old couple's pleasure was very great when they looked at him, for he was just what they thought a hero ought to be like. One day, Momotaro came to his foster father and said solemnly,
"Do you want to adultize the voice you just did?
Or I don't know how to do that.
Do you want me to be a teenager?"
Yeah, you can be teenage Momotaro.
How do teenagers talk these days?
Did it say, how old is he?
15.
15, okay. I don't know, 15, his voice has changed for sure.
He's, Father!
He's going to have a deeper voice now.
Father,
yeah, do that one.
Let's try to do like a male version of Valley voice. Like, bro, dad.
Yeah, do that.
By a strange chance, we have become father and son. Your goodness to me has been higher than the mountain grasses, which it was your daily work to cut, and deeper than the river where my mother washes the clothes. I do not know how to thank you enough.
Who has this kid been hanging out with? Where did he pick that up?
He's been hanging with the cool kids. Why?
Answered the old man.
It is a matter of course that a father should bring up his son. When you are older, it will be your turn to take care of us. So after all, there will be no profit or loss between us. All will be equal. Indeed, I am rather surprised that you should thank me in this way.
And the old man looked bothered.
I'm like,
you're going to have so much dialogue now.
I'm fixing the two voices already. I hope that you'll be patient with... I'm gonna struggle so hard. Yeah, dad. I hope that you'll be patient with me,
said Momotaro.
But before I begin to pay back their goodness to me, I have a request to make, which I hope you will grant me above anything else.
Is this too distracting? Momotaro's weird voice, because he has a lot of talking.
We'll see what happens here.
I'll try to keep a straight face and not, I don't want to crack you.
I will let you do whatever you wish, for you are quite different to all other boys. Then let me go away at once. What do you say? Do you wish to leave your old father and mother and go away from your old home? I will surely come back again if you let me go now. I think that's what the voice is going to have to be from now on.
All right.
Where are you going? You must think it strange that I want to go away,
said Momotaro,
because I have not yet told you my reason. Far away from here to the northeast of Japan, there is an island in the sea. The island is the stronghold of a band of devils.
Did Momotaro just turn into Paul? Because
I don't know. Sounds like maybe. Paul. I'm the hero, so yes. I have often heard how they invade the land, kill and rob the people, and carry off all they can find. They are not only very wicked, but they are disloyal to our emperor and disobey his laws. They are also cannibals, for they kill and eat some of the poor people who are so unfortunate as to fall into their hands. These devils are very hateful beings. I must go and conquer them and bring back all the plunder of which they have robbed this land. It is for this reason that I want to go away for a short time.
So quick note here. I know for a fact, just from knowing this story, that when he says devils, we're talking about Oni, right?
Yeah.
Oni translates to devil. But he says that they're cannibals because they eat people. Well, Oni aren't human, right?
Yeah, that's a little weird.
I don't know. Maybe just something I noticed.
Maybe they do eat devils too.
But he says that they're cannibals because they kill and eat some of the poor people who are so unfortunate as to fall into their hands.
Okay,
anyway, doesn't matter. The old man was much surprised at hearing all this from a mere boy of 15. He thought it best to let the boy go. He was strong and fearless, and besides all this, the old man knew he was no common child, for he had been sent to them as a gift from heaven, and he felt quite sure that the devils would be powerless to harm him.
"All you say is very interesting, Momotaro,"
said the old man.
"I will not hinder you in your determination. You may go if you wish. Go to the island as soon as ever you like, and destroy the demons and bring peace to our land."
"Thank you for all your kindness,"
said Momotaro, who began to get ready to go that very day. He was full of courage and did not know what fear was. The old man and woman at once set to work to pound rice in the kitchen mortar to make cakes for Momotaro to take with him on his journey. Mochi cakes, apparently.
Perfect travel food.
At last, the cakes were made and Momotaro was ready to start on his long journey. Parting is always sad. So it was now. The eyes of the two old people were filled with tears, and their voices trembled as they said,
"Go with all care and speed. We expect you back victorious."
Momotaro was very sorry to leave his old parents, though he knew he was coming back as soon as he could, for he thought of how lonely they would be while he was away. But he said,
"Goodbye,"
quite bravely.
"I am going now. Take good care of yourselves while I am away. Goodbye."
And he stepped quickly out of the house. In silence, the eyes of Momotaro and his parents met in farewell. Momotaro now hurried on his way till it was midday. He began to feel hungry, so he opened his bag and took out one of the rice cakes and sat down under a tree by the side of the road to eat it. While he was thus having his lunch, a dog, almost as large as a colt, came running out from the high grass. He made straight for Momotaro and, showing his teeth, said in a fierce way, "I think I'll take the animals since you have so much with Momotaro."
Okay.
So I'm thinking like a Scooby-Doo kind of voice.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
"You are a rude man to pass my field without asking permission first. If you leave me all the cakes you have in your bag, you may go. Otherwise, I will bite you till I kill you."
I don't know how to do Scooby-Doo voice.
That was great.
Momotaro only laughed scornfully.
"What is it that you are saying? Do you know who I am? I am Momotaro, and I am on my way to subdue the devils in their island stronghold in the northeast of Japan. If you try to stop me on my way there, I will cut you in two from the head downwards."
He really pulled the, "Don't you know who I am?"
Yeah, he's already dropped it. He's done anything yet.
I also, Paul, that last part, do you think "I will cut you in two from the head downwards"? Does that mean he's going to cut his head off, or does it mean he's going to start at the head and like slice him in two from his head down to his tail?
Yeah, that one. The head ladder, down to the
right?
Tail.
Yeah. Quite a threat.
Yeah.
The dog's manner at once changed. His tail dropped between his legs, and coming near, he bowed so low that his forehead touched the ground.
"What do I hear? The name of Momotaro. Are you indeed Momotaro? I've often heard of your great strength. Not knowing who you were, I have behaved in a very stupid way. Will you please pardon my rudeness?"
I'm trying to make it dog-like. I don't know.
Are you indeed on your way to invade the island of devils? If you will take such a rude fellow with you as one of your followers, I shall be very grateful to you."
"I think I could take you with me if you wish to go,"
said Momotaro.
"Thank you," said the dog. "By the way, I'm very hungry. Very, very hungry. Will you give me one of those cakes you're carrying?"
"This is the best kind of cake there is in Japan,"
said Momotaro.
"I cannot spare you a whole one, but I will give you half of one."
"Well, thank you very much,"
said the dog, taking the piece thrown to him. Then Momotaro got up and the dog followed. For a long time, they walked over the hills and through the valleys. As they were going along, an animal came down from a tree a little ahead of them. The creature soon came up to Momotaro and said,
"Good morning, Momotaro."
No, that's a Mickey Mouse voice.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Good morning, Momotaro. You are welcome in this part of the country. Will you allow me to go with you?
The dog answered jealously. Momotaro already has a dog to accompany him. Of what use is a monkey like you in battle? We're on our way to fight the devils. Get away.
The dog and the monkey began to quarrel and bite, for these two animals always hate each other.
Now don't quarrel,
said Momotaro, putting himself between them.
Wait a moment, dog.
It is not at all dignified for you to have such a creature as that following you, said the dog.
What do you know about it?
Asked Momotaro, and pushing aside the dog, he spoke to the monkey.
Who are you?
I am a monkey living in these hills,
replied the monkey.
I heard of your expedition to the Island of Devils.
This really sounds like Mickey Mouse. I said this is supposed to be a monkey.
I heard of your expedition to the Island of Devils.
Now it really does.
Well, now you just have that image in your head, right? Like, I think it always sounded like
that. I can't unhear it now. It's hoo hoo, not ha ha, right?
Monkey, monkey, oh,
monkey.
I heard of your expedition.
Stop laughing, Ball. You're going to...
Okay.
I can't do it.
I'll straight face it.
I heard of your expedition to the Island of Devils, and I've come to go with you. Nothing will please me more than to follow you.
Do you really wish to go to the Island of Devils and fight with me?
Yes, sir,
replied the monkey.
I admire your courage,
said Momotaro.
Here is a piece of one of my fine rice cakes. Come along.
So the monkey joined Momotaro. The dog and the monkey did not get on well together. They were always snapping at each other as they went along, and always wanting to have a fight. This made Momotaro very cross, and at last he sent the dog on ahead with a flag and put the monkey behind with a sword, and he placed himself between them with a war fan, which is made of iron. By and by, they came to a large field. Here, a bird flew down and alighted on the ground just in front of the little party. It was the most beautiful bird Momotaro had ever seen. On his body were five different robes of feathers, and his head was covered with a scarlet cap. The dog at once ran at the bird and tried to seize and kill it, but the bird struck out its spurs and flew at the dog's tail, and the fight went hard with both. Momotaro, as he looked on, could not help admiring the bird. It showed so much spirit in the fight. It would certainly make a good fighter. Momotaro went up to the two combatants, and holding the dog back, said to the bird,
"You rascal! You are hindering my journey! Surrender at once, and I will take you with me. If you don't, I will set this dog to bite your head off."
Sounds good to me.
I just made that up. That's not in there. Then the bird surrendered at once, and begged to be taken into Momotaro's company.
"I do not know what excuse to offer for quarreling with the dog, your servant, but I did not see you."
It's more hoo-hoo-hoo, but that sounds, is that more like a bird hoo-hoo? I don't know.
Cuckoo is bird.
This is actually a pheasant, spoiler. Okay. It says later on, okay. But I don't know what a pheasant sounds like.
Right.
Maybe I'm thinking mourning dove. Something like that. Oh, it's the next sentence.
"I do not know what excuse to offer for quarreling with the dog, your servant, but I did not see you. I am a miserable bird called a pheasant. It is very generous of you to pardon my rudeness and take me with you, cuckoo. Please allow me to follow you behind the dog and the monkey."
"I congratulate you on surrendering so soon,"
said Momotaro, smiling.
"Come and join us in our raid on the devils."
"Are you going to take this bird with you also?"
said the dog, interrupting.
"Why do you ask such an unnecessary question? Didn't you hear what I said? I take the bird with me because I wish to."
"Do you know who I am? I'm Momotaro. I take whoever I want with me."
said the dog. Then Momotaro stood and gave this order.
"Now all of you must listen to me. The first thing necessary in an army is harmony. It is a wise saying which says that advantage on earth is better than advantage in heaven. Union amongst ourselves is better than any earthly gain. When we are not at peace amongst ourselves, it is no easy thing to subdue an enemy. From now, you three, the dog, the monkey, and the pheasant, must be friends with one mind.
The one who first begins a quarrel will be discharged on the spot.
All the three promised not to quarrel. The pheasant was now made a member of Momotaro's suite and received half a cake. Momotaro's influence was so great that the three became good friends and hurried onwards with him as their leader. Hurrying on day after day, they at last came out upon the shore of the northeastern sea. There was nothing to be seen as far as the horizon, not a sign of any island. All that broke the stillness was the rolling of the waves upon the shore. Now the dog and the monkey and the pheasant had come very bravely all the way through the long valleys and over the hills, but they had never seen the sea before, and for the first time since they set out, they were bewildered and gazed at each other in silence. How were they to cross the water to get to the island of devils? Momotaro soon saw that they were daunted by the sight of the sea, and to try them, he spoke loudly and roughly.
Why do you hesitate? Are you afraid of the sea? Oh, what cowards you are! It is impossible to take such weak creatures as you with me to fight the demons. It will be far better for me to go alone. I discharge you all at once.
The three animals were taken aback at this sharp reproof and clung to Momotaro's sleeve, begging him not to send them away.
Please, Momotaro, said the dog.
We've come this far, said the monkey. It's inhuman to leave us here.
Is that what a pheasant sounds
yeah,
like?
Yeah, there you go.
It's inhuman to leave us here, said the pheasant. We are not at all afraid of the sea,
said the monkey again.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
That's monkey.
Please do take us with you.
I realize that the pheasant and the monkey sound very similar. I don't know. I'm not a voice actor. I'm finding out that I don't think I have what it takes.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
Please do take us with you,
said the pheasant.
Do please,
said the dog. They had now gained a little courage, so Momotaro said,
Well then, I will take you with me, but be careful.
Momotaro now got a small ship, and they all got on board. The wind and weather were fair, and the ship went like an arrow over the sea. It was the first time they had ever been on the water, and so at first the dog, the monkey, and the pheasant were frightened at the waves and the rolling of the vessel. But by degrees they grew accustomed to the water and were quite happy again. Every day they paced the deck of their little ship, eagerly looking out for the Demon's Island. When they grew tired of this, they told each other stories of all their exploits of which they were proud, and then played games together. And Momotaro found much to amuse him in listening to the three animals and watching their antics, and in this way he forgot that the way was long and that he was tired of the voyage and of doing nothing. He longed to be at work killing the monsters who had done so much harm in his country. As the wind blew in their favor, and they met no storms, the ship made a quick voyage, and one day when the sun was shining brightly, a sight of land rewarded the four watchers at the bow. Momotaro knew at once that what they saw was the devil's stronghold. On the top of the precipitous shore, looking out to sea, was a large castle. Now that his enterprise was close at hand, he was deep in thought with his head leaning on his hands, wondering how he should begin the attack. His three followers watched him, waiting for orders. At last he called to the pheasant.
It is a great advantage for us to have you with us,
said Momotaro to the bird.
For you have good wings. Fly at once to the castle and engage the demons to fight. We will follow you.
And the pheasant's like, What? You're sending me all by myself? But actually, the pheasant at once obeyed. He flew off from the ship, beating the air gladly with his wings. The bird soon reached the island and took up his position on the roof in the middle of the castle, calling out loudly,
All you devils, listen to me! The great Japanese general Momotaro has come to fight you and to take your stronghold from you. If you wish to save your life, surrender at once. And in token of your submission, you must break off the horns that grow on your forehead. If you do not surrender at once, but make up your mind to fight, we, the pheasant, the dog, and the monkey, will kill you all by biting and tearing you to death. Grrr! I'm a scary pheasant.
That was a great pheasant speech.
Thanks. The horned demons, looking up and only seeing a pheasant, laughed and said,
a wild pheasant indeed. It is ridiculous to hear such words from a mean thing like you. Wait till you get a blow from one of our iron bars.
Oh, f*** you.
Very angry indeed were the devils, especially at that profanity from the pheasant. Jeez. They shook their horns and their shocks of red hair fiercely, and rushed to put on tiger skin trousers to make themselves look more terrible. Then they brought out great iron bars and ran to where the pheasant perched over their heads and tried to knock him down. Iron bars, by the way, we know that that's a common weapon of the Oni, right? A kanabo. Yeah? Mm. Big studded club kind of thing.
The bad guy in that Chinese story also was an iron bar wielder.
He did, yeah. The pheasant flew to one side to escape the blow, and then attacked the head of first one and then another demon. He flew round and round them, beating the air with his wings so fiercely and ceaselessly that the devils began to wonder whether they had to fight one or many more birds. In the meantime, Momotaro had brought his ship to land. As they had approached, he saw that the shore was like a precipice, and that the large castle was surrounded by high walls and large iron gates and was strongly fortified. Momotaro landed, and with the hope of finding some way of entrance, walked up the path towards the top, followed by the monkey and the dog. They soon came upon two beautiful damsels washing clothes in a stream. Momotaro saw that the clothes were blood-stained, and that as the two maidens washed, the tears were falling fast down their cheeks. He stopped and spoke to them.
"Who are you, and why do you weep?"
"We are captives of the Demon King. We were carried away from our homes to this island, and though we are the daughters of daimyos,"
it notes lords, daimyos translates to lords,
"we are obliged to be his servants, and one day he will kill us."
And the maidens held up the blood-stained clothes.
"And eat us, and there is no one to help us."
And their tears burst out afresh at this horrible thought.
"I will rescue you," said Momotaro. "Do not weep anymore. Only show me how I may get into the castle."
Then the two ladies led the way and showed Momotaro a little back door in the lowest part of the castle wall, so small that Momotaro could hardly crawl in. The pheasant, who was all this time fighting hard and probably wondering where the heck his companions are, holy crap, saw Momotaro and his little band rush in at the back. Momotaro's onslaught was so furious that the devils could not stand against him. At first, their foe had been a single bird, the pheasant. But now that Momotaro and the dog and the monkey had arrived, they were bewildered, for the four enemies fought like 100, so strong were they. Some of the devils fell off the parapet of the castle and were dashed to pieces on the rocks beneath. Others fell into the sea and were drowned. Many were beaten to death by the three animals. The chief of the devils at last was the only one left. He made up his mind to surrender, for he knew that his enemy was stronger than mortal man. He came up humbly to Momotaro and threw down his iron bar, and kneeling down at the victor's feet, he broke off the horns on his head in token of submission, for they were the sign of his strength and power.
"I am afraid of you," he said meekly. "I cannot stand against you. I will give you all the treasure hidden in this castle, if you will spare my life."
Momotaro laughed. You can tell he's a teenager sometimes, you know. He's laughing at this. "Do you know who I am?" It's teenager stuff, right?
Like that? Teenage laugh.
I need a little more scorn in the laugh, you know. There you go. Sneering, yeah, yeah.
"It's not like you, big devil, to beg for mercy, is it?"
Oh, so snarky, Momotaro. Jeez.
"I cannot spare your wicked life, however much you beg, for you have killed and tortured many people and robbed our country for many years."
Then Momotaro tied the devil chief up and gave him into the monkey's charge. Having done this, he went into all the rooms of the castle and set the prisoners free and gathered together all the treasure he found. The dog and the pheasant carried home the plunder, and thus Momotaro returned triumphantly to his home, taking with him the devil chief as a captive. So he said he can't spare his life, right? He's going to kill him. Why does he need to bring him home first?
I don't know.
The two poor damsels, daughters of daimyos, and others whom the wicked demon had carried off to be his slaves, were taken safely to their own homes and delivered to their parents. The whole country made a hero of Momotaro on his triumphant return and rejoiced that the country was now freed from the robber devils who had been a terror of the land for a long time. The old couple's joy was greater than ever, and the treasure Momotaro had brought home with him enabled them to live in peace and plenty to the end of their days.
That's quite a story. Wow, that was good.
That's a fun one.
Yeah.
Always liked that story. Had you heard many different versions of this in the past?
I don't think so.
Were you like vaguely familiar with the story?
Yeah. It sounded like familiar-ish.
Yeah. I've heard various versions, but never one quite this verbose.
Yeah.
But I like the detail. Well, Paul.
Yeah?
Before we go,
mm-hmm.
Got a surprise for us.
Okay.
Yeah. We have some listener mail to open.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, we have received a package from Shaked Rosenthal, one of our Shogun-level patrons.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Shaked. We've been talking a lot on, I guess, Facebook Messenger, and he's actually planning on meeting up with us at the meetup on our trip.
Sweet. So
I'm very excited to be able to thank him in person. So I feel like the last couple packages we've gotten, I think you opened them, so if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Okay. So we have a bag here. It feels like there's a box inside the bag. Oh, there's also a tag on the bag with a very nice message. Thank you for hours of enjoyment during one of the more tough and complicated times of my life. Thank you for giving me something to look forward to and plan towards. From Shaked.
All right.
That's very nice.
Yeah, nice.
And I'm glad we could help.
Jason's delicately opening the bag. All right, now we got a box. There was a box inside the bag.
Thank you for narrating so I can focus on it. Dude, Paul can't see yet, but I'm excited about this. It's a game called Let's Go to Japan.
Okay, like a board game?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
This is awesome.
That's fantastic.
We actually have a friend group that gets together semi-regularly to play at board games. This is perfect.
Yeah.
This will be super fun.
Sweet.
Thank you so much, Shaked.
Thank you.
Should I read the synopsis or the should sure. I read the little
sure.
copy on the back? You are travelers planning and experiencing your own dream vacations to Japan. While bouncing between Tokyo and Kyoto, you'll visit can't-miss tourist attractions and local flavor. Using 160 beautifully illustrated cards, you will discover activities and strategically place them to create your week-long itinerary. Puzzle out the optimal activities to maximize your experience while balancing your resources. Play competitively or solo, earning victory points by successfully navigating the cities, making the most out of your favorite activities, and fulfilling your personal goals. The most points wins, but everyone has the chance to create a memorable vacation. I can't imagine a more fitting game for this podcast. Like, wow.
This could not be more up our alley.
Yeah. I can't wait. This is going to be fun. What a nice guy.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, before we go, let me again mention our upcoming meetup this fall in Tokyo. We're going to be at Commune on the rooftop of the Shibuya Parco Shopping Mall at 7 p.m., November 6th, 2024. Those details are also in the show notes if you want to check them out. We got the Google Maps link and everything. Also should mention our Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes or on our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com.
If you like the folklore episode, we have some more folklore episodes that you'll gain access to if you become a patron.
A bunch of exclusive folktale episodes on the Patreon. But wait, Paul, we have another announcement about the Patreon, right?
Oh, yeah. The unfortunate news.
Yeah, Patreon just told us that Apple is requiring them to use Apple's in-app payment system in order to stay on the App Store, which means that if you
join our Patreon through the app on an iPhone, Apple is going to charge an extra 30% in fees, which is crazy. Especially because, like, I don't know, it's just easy to avoid. It's just inconvenient. Like, if you join our Patreon through your desktop computer, like on the website, or even just on the browser on your phone on the website, you avoid the fee. So if you do want to support the podcast, which we very much appreciate, thank you very much for thinking of doing that, just do it through a browser and avoid the fee. It doesn't make any sense. And we're sorry that that's a thing.
Yeah.
But Apple's making moves. I don't know. But for existing members, that does not affect you. So don't worry about it. They're not going to add any fees for you. So
that's nice.
Yeah. By the way, I want to thank our Shogun level patrons. I mean, a huge thank you to all of our patrons, of course, as always. But let me mention our Shogun level patrons: Wesley C., Nicholas McKibben, Kevin Harris, Brady K., Jack, Michael Morris, David Imani, Darwin Perrier, Ethan Teague, Yasmin, Jason, Katarina and Ellery, Susan, Tori, Tina Anderson, and, of course, Shaked Rosenthal. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And for everyone else, if you're not interested in joining the Patreon, you could also support us by writing a review. Paul, what's coming up next time?
Our next episode is the long-awaited and requested game shows and reality TV in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Is Japanese TV really as crazy as it seems sometimes?
Even crazier. I don't know, in some ways. I learned a lot. I actually found that I had some misconceptions, I think.
Yeah.
There were certain things about Japanese TV I didn't quite understand, and I'm glad to have done the research.
Listen next time for the full story.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.